But Neolithic man was thinking about these words. He was thinking about a number of things with a great deal of verbal confusion and getting to some odd conclusions. In speech, he had woven a net to bind his race together, but also it was a net about his feet. Man was binding himself into new and larger and more efficient combinations indeed, but at a price. One of the most notable things about the Neolithic age is the total absence of that free, direct artistic impulse which was the supreme quality of later Paleolithic man. We find much industry, much skill, polished implements, pottery with conventional designs, cooperation upon all sorts of things, but no evidence of personal creativeness. Self-suppression is beginning for men. Man has entered upon the long and tortuous and difficult path towards a life for the common good, with all its sacrifice of personal impulse, which he is still treading today. Certain things appear in the mythology of mankind again and again. Neolithic man was enormously impressed by serpents, and he no longer took the sun for granted. Nearly everywhere that Neolithic culture went, there went a disposition to associate the sun and the serpent in decoration and worship. This primitive serpent worship spread ultimately far beyond the regions where the snake is of serious practical importance in human life. Sixth, with the beginnings of agriculture, a fresh set of ideas arose in men's minds. We've already indicated how easily and naturally men have come to associate the idea of sowing with a burial. Sir J.G. Fraser has pursued the development of this association in the human mind, linking up with it the conception of special sacrificial persons who are killed at seed time, the conception of a specially purified class of people to kill these sacrifices, the first priests, and the conception of a sacrament, a ceremonial feast, in which the tribe eats portions of the body of the victim in order to share in the sacrificial benefits. Out of these factors, out of the old man tradition, out of the emotions that surround women for men and men for women, out of the desire to escape infection and uncleanness, out of the desire for power and success through magic, out of the sacrificial tradition of seed time, and out of a number of like beliefs and mental experiments and misconceptions, a complex something was growing up in the lives of men which was beginning to bind them together mentally and emotionally in a common life and action. This something we may call religion, Latin religare, to bind. It was not a simple or logical something, it was a tangle of ideas about commanding beings and spirits, about gods, about all sorts of musts and must-nots. Like all other human matters, religion has grown. It must be clear from what's gone before that primitive man, much less his ancestral apes and his ancestral Mesozoic mammals, could have had no idea of God or religion. Only very slowly did his brain and his powers of comprehension become capable of such general conceptions. Religion is something that has grown up with and through human association, and God has been, and is still being, discovered by man. This book is not a theological book, and it's not for us to embark upon theological discussion, but it's a part, a necessary and central part of the history of man, to describe the dawn and development of his religious ideas and their influence upon his activities. All these factors we've noted must have contributed to this development, and various writers have laid most stress upon one or other of them. Sir J.G. Fraser has been the leading student of the derivation of sacraments from magic sacrifices. Grant Allen, following Herbert Spencer in his evolution of the idea of God, laid stress chiefly on the posthumous worship of the old man. Sir E.B. Tyler, in Primitive Culture, gave his attention mainly to the disposition of primitive man to ascribe a soul to every object animate and inanimate. Mr. A. Crawley, in The Tree of Life, has called attention to other centres of impulse and emotion, and particularly to sex, as a source of deep excitement. The thing we have to bear in mind is that Neolithic man was still mentally undeveloped. He could be confused and illogical to a degree quite impossible to an educated modern person. Conflicting and contradictory ideas could lie in his mind without challenging one another. Now one thing ruled his thoughts intensely and vividly, and now another. His fears, his acts, were still disconnected, as children's are. Confusedly, under the stimulus of the need and possibility of cooperation and a combined life, Neolithic mankind was feeling out for guidance and knowledge. Men were becoming aware that personally they needed protection and direction, cleansing from impurity, power beyond their own strength. Confusedly, in response to that demand, bold men, wise men, shrewd and cunning men were arising to become magicians, priests, chiefs, and kings. They're not to be thought of as cheats or usurpers of power, nor the rest of mankind as their dupes. All men are mixed in their motives. 100 things move men to seek ascendancy over other men, but not all such motives are base or bad. The magicians usually believed more or less in their own magic, the priests in their ceremonies, the chiefs in their right. The history of mankind henceforth is a history of more or less blind endeavours to conceive a common purpose in relation to which all men may live happily, and to create and develop a common consciousness and a common stock of knowledge which may serve and illuminate that purpose. In a vast variety of forms, this appearance of kings and priests and magic men was happening all over the world under Neolithic conditions. Everywhere, mankind was seeking where knowledge and mastery and magic power might reside. Everywhere, individual men were willing, honestly or dishonestly, to rule, to direct, or to be the magic beings who would reconcile the confusions of the community. Another queer development of the later Paleolithic and Neolithic ages was the development of self-mutilation. Men began to cut themselves about, to excise noses, ears, fingers, teeth, and the like, and to attach all sorts of superstitious ideas to these acts. Many children today pass through a similar phase in their mental development. There's a phase in the life of most little girls when they're not to be left alone with a pair of scissors for fear that they will cut off their hair. No animal does anything of this sort. In many ways, the simplicity, directness, and detachment of a later Paleolithic rock painter appeal more to modern sympathies than does the state of mind of these Neolithic men, full of the fear of some ancient old man who had developed into a tribal god, obsessed by ideas of sacrificial propitiations, mutilations, and magic murder. No doubt the reindeer hunter was a ruthless hunter, and a combative and passionate creature, but he killed for reasons we can still understand. Neolithic man, under the sway of talk and a confused thought process, killed on theory. He killed for monstrous and now incredible ideas. He killed those he loved through fear and under direction. Those Neolithic men not only made human sacrifices at seed time, there's every reason to suppose they sacrificed wives and slaves at the burial of their chieftains. They killed men, women, and children whenever they were under adversity and thought the gods were athirst. They practiced infanticide. All these things passed on into the Bronze Age. Hitherto, a social consciousness had been asleep and not even dreaming in human history. Before it awakened, it produced nightmares. Away beyond the dawn of history, 3,000 or 4,000 years ago, one thinks of the Wiltshire uplands in the twilight of a midsummer day's morning. The torches pale in the growing light. One has a dim apprehension of a procession through the avenue of stone, of priests, perhaps fantastically dressed with skins and horns and horrible painted masks, not the robed and bearded dignitaries our artists represent the Druids to have been. Of chiefs in skins adorned with necklaces of teeth, and bearing spears and axes, their great heads of hair held up with pins of bone, of women in skins or flaxen robes, of a great peering crowd of shock-headed men and naked children. They've assembled from many distant places. The ground between the avenues and Silbury Hill is dotted with their encampments. A certain festive cheerfulness prevails, and, amidst the throng, march the appointed human victims, submissive, helpless, staring towards the distant smoking altar at which they are to die, that the harvests may be good and the tribe increase. To that had life progressed 3,000 or 4,000 years ago from its starting place in the slime of the tidal beaches.